Though I had previously made a trip into the then territory of Dakota beyond the Red River, it was not until 1883 that I went to the Little Missouri and there took hold of two cattle ranches, the Chimney Butte and the Elkhorn. It was still the Wild West in those days, the Far West, the West of Owen Wister's stories and Frederick Remington's drawings, the West of the Indian and the buffalo hunter, the soldier and the cowpuncher. That land of the West has gone now, gone, gone with the lost Atlantis, gone to the Isle of ghosts and of strange dead memories. It was a land of vast silent spaces, of lonely rivers, and of plains where the wild game stared at the passing horseman. It was a land of scattered ranches, of herds of long-horned cattle, and of reckless riders who, unmoved, looked into the eyes of life or death. In that land we led a free and hardy life with horse and rifle. We worked under the scorching midsummer sun when the wide plains shimmered and wavered in the heat, and we knew the freezing misery of riding night guard round the cattle in the late fall roundup. In the soft springtime, the stars were glorious in our eyes each night before we fell asleep, and in the winter we rode through blinding blizzards when the driven snow dust burnt our faces. There were monotonous days as we guided the trail cattle or the beef herds, hour after hour at the slowest of walks, and minutes or hours teeming with excitement as we stopped stampedes or swam the herds across rivers treacherous with quicksands or brimmed with running ice. We knew toil and hardship and hunger and thirst, and we saw men die violent deaths as they worked among the horses and cattle or fought in evil feuds with one another. But we felt the beat of hardy life in our veins, and ours was the glory of work and the joy of living. Theodore Roosevelt, 1913. And now, the Great American Folk Show, a little place on the radio where we commune with you to share stories, sing songs, and talk to some good people with great voices. Stay with us over the next hour as we bring you playwriter Kemp Powers, musician Isabella Rose, writer Gianni Washington, Otsley Kilcher of the reality TV show Alaska, The Last Frontier. Plus, singer-songwriter Richard Buckner reads from his new book, Cuttings from the Tangle. I'm Joe Wiegand. Good to have you with us. Here's your host, Tom Brousseau.
An older live recording of mine with musicians Kelly Hogan and Scott Ligon from 2005 from our Shubas residency. Shubas was a lovely venue in Chicago, and sadly it closed over the outbreak last year. The song is called Emma, and it was written by Richard Buckner. And since he's a guest on the show today, he'll be coming up in the second half, I thought I'd share it. It's a great song, and it was so much fun for me back then to perform with Scott and Kelly. What intuitive musicians. I'm just glad there's a recording of it, so I know it actually happened.
Sorry for you, Emma, I'm sorry for you.
I'm sorry for
you. Going away with a man you don't love. Looks like the good Lord has given you up. Oh, Emma, I'm sorry.
Emma loves the Cherokee City.
Emma.
Oh, she loves her father so well.
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 Oh, but he made a man when her mama died in love. She fell down to the ground and cried. But Emma loves her. Emma, I'm sorry for you.
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 Oh, went away with a man you don't love. It looks like the good Lord is giving. Emma, I'm sorry for you.
Emma, I'm sorry for you.
Thank you. That was a Richard Buckner song.
I met Kemp Powers in 2009 in Los Angeles, California. He was an independent journalist back then, writing for publications such as Newsweek and Forbes and Vibe magazine. A few years before this, he authored a memoir entitled The Shooting, and you may have heard him on the famous Moth Radio Hour talking about it. Kemp grew up in Brooklyn, New York. He and his friends created their own comic books for fun, and Kemp was the one to always come up with a storyline. In 2013, in an interview with playwright Adam Simkowitz, he commented, "I guess I was just the best at articulating an idea within our little group of neighborhood kids." Well, that may be. But I have to tell you, thinking something is one thing, and writing it out is a whole other deal. It takes time. You have to edit. One day you might write a page, and the next day you throw it all out. I guess what I'm saying is some people are just natural-born writers. Kemp's a celebrated playwright, and lately he's been working in Hollywood. Last year saw the release of two movies in which he was closely involved. He co-wrote and co-directed the Disney movie Soul, and he wrote the screenplay for One Night in Miami, which is also based on his play of the same name. Both films have achieved critical and popular acclaim. Put them on your list if you haven't seen them yet. They're terrific. Kemp Powers joins us now from Los Angeles, California. Kemp, so great to have you on the show.
Thanks, man. It's good to be here.
One Night in Miami, February 25th, 1964, the Hampton House Motel, Miami, Florida. It's about four friends sharing a moment together. Cassius Clay, Malcolm X, R&B legend Sam Cooke, and perhaps the greatest running back of all time, Jim Brown. What went into bringing the stories and the confluence of these historical men to the stage?
It was a real night that happened. I've always been just a major history buff and a huge fan of all four of these men for very different reasons. And when I read a paragraph in a book one day that just mentioned that the night February 25th, 1964, when Cassius beat Sonny Liston, no one actually thought he was going to win. People forget that he was a massive underdog. That's why he shook up the world, so to speak. No party was planned. So he went back to his friend Malcolm X's room in the still segregated black section of town and spent the night in quiet conversation with Malcolm, Sam Cooke, and Jim Brown over bowls of vanilla ice cream. And the next morning is when he announced it to the world that he was in the Nation of Islam. It was just a throwaway paragraph in a greater story about Muhammad Ali. But to me, thinking about the confluence of these four men and what each of them really represented, I saw it as a really incredible opportunity to explore on stage this conversation that I feel is a conversation that Black people have been having for a long time, long before that night, up to this day, and particularly Black creatives. It's this question of, like, what, if any, social responsibility does the Black artist, the Black singer, the Black public figure, the Black athlete have to their community, and what's the best way to move their community forward?
And how did they succeed, each of these men? Cassius Clay, Sam Cooke, Jim Brown, Malcolm X, how did they succeed in the end?
Well, you know, the story is kind of like, despite all the successes they had, it's kind of a tragedy, man. I mean, within less than a year from this night, two of these guys would be gone. Both Malcolm X and Sam Cooke would be shot and killed.
I was born by the river.
Malcolm X in an assassination, and Sam Cooke in a very controversial shooting that happened in a motel in Los Angeles. And so for me, I was looking at this story as much as they accomplished, how much more could they have accomplished together? I mean, Sam Cooke for me was a real entry point into this story because his presence was what fascinated me the most. I mean, just looking at Sam Cooke's music, his civil rights anthem, A Change Is Gonna Come, it literally became the anthem of the civil rights movement. But you have to understand, when I was younger, I didn't know that the same person who sang that song also sang Cupid.
Mm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I didn't know that the same person who sang Bring It On Home to Me also sang You Send Me and Chain Gang. So Sam Cooke, for me as a child, it was kind of like Row, Row, Row Your Boat or the Happy Birthday song. It's just music you know, and you don't even know who's made this music. So when I first heard the name Sam Cooke mentioned probably by my mom, because it was actually my grandmother's favorite artist, you know, it was a name I heard who I knew was a singer from a different generation. But it wasn't until I was much older, like probably a teenager, that I started making the connection that this one guy had created all these songs.
I know you send me
that really were so catchy and so powerful for different reasons. And I just became kind of almost obsessed with Sam Cooke and his music, just because, one, I love so much of his music. His voice was like one of those once-in-a-generation voices. But then the more you learn about him, the more you realize how he was so far ahead of his time. He was such a trailblazer. You know, he was one of the first soul singer artists who really strove to have the rights to his own music, to keep his masters. And he really understood the importance of publishing. Things that, you know, at a time when artists would get paid with new cars, Sam was concerned about things that were, you know, that displayed a certain amount of business acumen that I think was really, really way ahead of his time. So he was both influential from a musical standpoint to so many other artists. We already know folks like Otis Redding to like Rod Stewart. And, you know, you can hear the stylings of Sam Cooke in so many songs. His trademark yodel, you know. Oh, like every time you hear the yodel in R&B, it's like that's a Sam Cooke thing. And his range was so incredible. And he was always his own songwriter. That's the other thing, is a lot of times artists from the 40s and 50s and 60s didn't write their own music. And Sam Cooke starting, because, you know, he of course started in gospel, and he was the youngest member of the Soul Stirrers. When he was 19 years old, he became the lead singer of the Soul Stirrers, which was the biggest gospel group in the country. But not only was he the lead singer, but he was writing and producing their songs at 19. And if you look at photos of the Soul Stirrers featuring Sam Cooke, the first question you ask yourself when you see the photos is, what is that kid doing with those old men? Seriously, you see them and you go like, why is there a kid in the group? Like, what was he doing on the bus with these old fellas? And it's like, not only was he the lead, he was writing the music. And for the traveling through the South, going from church to church, I mean, Sam was the attraction. He was the one who was making young girls want to go to church.
Well, you mentioned those songs. You Send Me, Twisting the Night Away, Cupid, Chain Gang, Another Saturday Night, Wonderful World, Don't Know Much About History. I mean, these are songs that I think so many people inherently just know.
Yeah.
And he wrote all of these songs.
All of them. Every one of them.
And not to mention the song that you were talking about a couple of minutes ago, Change Is Gonna Come. And the tone of that song is quite a bit different than the ones that I just mentioned.
He was inspired, I mean, a number of things. I mean, of course, Sam spent a lot of the early part of his career having to perform to segregated audiences. And he was the earliest form of code switching. You know, he performed a very different show in front of white crowds than he did in front of black crowds. Probably the best example of Sam in front of a black crowd is, of course, the incredible, probably one of the greatest live R&B albums ever recorded, Live at the Harlem Square Club, which he recorded in Miami, Harlem Square Club in 1963, about a year before the Cassius Clay Liston fight.
You feel like you're on a twist for a while now, huh?
But what people don't realize about that album is he recorded it in 63. It didn't get released until the mid-1980s. It was one of those things where they recorded it, but at the time, releasing a live R&B album was not a thing people did. So it was just kind of like sitting around for decades and decades, and then in the mid-80s, it finally got released and became one of the greatest R&B albums of all time, because you're hearing this raw, visceral Sam Cooke that we'd never heard on vinyl before. But, you know, I think that Sam was obviously getting very exhausted by and beaten down by the segregation and stopped standing for it. He started demanding integrated crowds at his concerts, and, you know, it got him into lots of trouble traveling in the South. And of course, when he heard Bob Dylan's Blowing in the Wind, that was a transformative moment for him. You know, Sam Cooke, he heard that song and he said that he wished that he'd written it.
What I want to know is how many deaths.
You know, it was a song that was speaking to something greater, and I think that was one of the things that sent him on the path, the combination of hearing Bob Dylan's Blowing in the Wind and experiencing the things that he had been experiencing on the road in the South, I think prompted him to write A Change Is Gonna Come, which, of course, is really one of the most impactful elements of his legacy, and he never lived to see the impact of the song. It was released as a single after he died.
Yeah.
He performed it once live on The Tonight Show, which we actually recreate in the film. But yeah, he performed it one time.
That's a fact. He did perform it on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson.
Yes.
But the footage is just
sort of
lost. Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of footage from that era is lost. His opening song, in the movie we have the opening song Good Times, but in reality, the opening song was Basin Street Blues. I believe that might still be intact. I think you can see, if you go onto YouTube, him doing Basin Street Blues on The Tonight Show. But then he went, sat on the couch, and then did another number, and that number was Change Is Gonna Come, and that's gone.
You've become sort of a biographer of Sam Cooke. Your fascination goes back to when you were a kid, these songs. Your mother played them, and they just became a part of you. And you mentioned a lot of things already. We briefly touched on the Soul Stirrers. I think a lot of people out there might know Sam Cooke, but they might not know the Soul Stirrers. And Sam was a part of that group before he went on a solo career.
And he supported the group even after he became a pop artist. You know, Sam started his own record label, Sar Records, and one of the first groups he signed to Sar was the Soul Stirrers. So he actually continued to support the publishing and the release of not just pop music, but also gospel music. He always loved gospel music his entire life. So even when he wasn't the lead singer of the Soul Stirrers, he was a supporter of the group. And the group continued to make some pretty great music. And in fact, if you have an opportunity, there's a great double disc set called the Sam Cooke, The Sar Record Story. I'm sure you could just order it on Amazon. And it's pretty great because it's basically the entirety of the artists from his Sar Records labels. And it has a lot of, so Sam Cooke's music isn't actually on it. It's just all the artists he signed to Sar Records. So you get to hear a lot of Soul Stirrers music. You get to hear the Valentinos, who, of course, was the Womack brothers, the young, you know, including Bobby Womack. So, you know, you get to hear Mel Carter. You get to just hear a whole array of R&B, soul, and gospel artists. Of course, Billy Preston, the great Billy Preston, was a Sar Records artist. So, you know, some really, and everyone knows Billy Preston ended up, you know, recording for years and performing with, among other groups, the Beatles. And the influence of even the gospel group, the Soul Stirrers, goes beyond Sam Cooke. Like, there's one great Soul Stirrer song, Stand By Me, Father, which is just such a lovely tune, like a powerful tune. And I believe that it's partially the influence for Stand By Me.
Oh, wow.
And when you hear Stand By Me, Father, you can totally hear it. You know, like it's, of course, Stand By Me, the lyrics are very distinct, you know, when the night is young, but the chorus, there are so many similarities. Of course, Stand By Me, Father, is he's not similar, just like what Sam would do. It's not, instead of darling, Stand By Me, it's Stand By Me, Father. It's like my Jesus, when I'm at my lowest, when I'm in my darkest place, I know I'm not alone, you know, stand mm-hmm. by me, Father, like you stood by Daniel down in the lion's den. It's very within the traditional, you know, gospel realm, but you can immediately see how that would be an influence for Stand By Me.
Well, I think we've got to hear a song. Would you do the honor and maybe introduce your favorite Sam Cooke song?
With Sam Cooke and the Soul Stirrers, Touch the Hem of His Garment.
Oh, that was a woman. In the Bible days, she had been sick, sick so very long. But she heard my Jesus was passing by, so she joined the gathering throng. And while she was pushing her way through, someone asked her, "What are you trying to do?" She said, "If I just touch the hem of his garment, I know I'll be made whole." She cried, "Oh, and oh, and oh, and oh, and oh." Said, "If I could just touch the hem of his garment, I know I'll be made whole." And oh, she spent her money here and there, until she had no more to spare. The doctors, they done all they could, but their medicine would do no good. When she touched him, the Savior didn't see, but still he turned around and cried, "Somebody touch me." She said, "It was I who just wanna touch the hem of your garment. I know I'll be made whole right now." She stood there crying, "Oh, oh, 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 and oh, oh, Lord, and oh, oh, Lord." Said, "If I could just touch the hem of your garment, I know I'll be made whole right now."
You're listening to The Great American Folk Show. I'm Tom Brousseau, and I'm speaking right now with Kemp Powers. He's a playwright and screenwriter behind the critically hailed One Night in Miami. Kemp, could you talk a little bit about the play? What were the challenges of adapting it into a film?
Yeah, so like when you're a screenwriter, often you'll be given a book or a play or something like that. It's source material. Someone will tell you, like, you know, read this and see what you take away from it, and like, how would you think about it if you have a take on how you would adapt it into a film. And with adapting One Night in Miami, honestly, man, I just use my play as a piece of source material. I try not to be precious about it. I'm like, okay, approach this as though it's someone else's play. It's just a piece of source material. What would be your take on this story as a movie? And while I thought certain thematic elements needed to be the same, story-wise, I wasn't beholden to anything that was really in the play other than it was going to have these four guys in it. And once I kind of did that, it really freed me up quite a bit. I mean, there's so many things that I was able to do writing a film script that weren't even possibilities in the play. You know, so much of what made the play special to me and made it work was the fact that it was real time. It began when the four of them entered the room, and it ended 85 minutes later when they left the room.
It's literally in the room of a hotel.
Yes, the whole time, yeah. The whole run, mm-hmm. and it's real time. There's no time jumps, nothing. So, mm-hmm. And that doesn't sound fun for a film. That doesn't sound like a, that sounds more like an endurance test than a piece of cinema that I want to sit through. It works perfectly fine, I think, on the stage. So with the film, I wanted to thematically still recreate this idea of being a fly on the wall, but I felt like the story had to be a different story. It had to be a bigger story than the story of simply Cassius Clay's victory and him not being able to decide whether or not he wants to become a member of the Nation of Islam. And of course, the story for the film, Malcolm X takes much more center stage in terms of the challenges that he presents to the group, specifically to Cassius Clay. I'm also allowed to kind of put these men into greater context, show you the world in which they're living with, and show you the wounds which I believe each of them walked into that room with on that given night. I worried when I was first doing this, like, okay, if I write this as a film, what's the point of ever seeing the play? But the play and the movie are so different. You know, I hope the play continues to have a life because it's actually a different experience. Some of the parts of the play that are the most popular aren't even in the movie. You know, there's a part of the play where we really do a deep dive into Sam Cooke's music. Interesting that we're talking about Sam Cooke. And he talks at length about playing for different audiences and tapping into their inner sister flute. And it ends with him like recreating a performance at the Harlem Square Club. And it's like a really show-stopping moment in the stage play. None of that is in the movie, because it doesn't serve the story that I'm trying to tell.
And you've taken this play everywhere. I mean, you've been over to Europe with this play. You've been all around the United States with this play.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't go. It played in South Africa. I didn't have a chance to go because I was working on a movie for something that started at a little 99-seat theater at Rogue Machine in Los Angeles next to Roscoe's. I would have never imagined that it would have connected with an audience the way that it has and gone so many different places. And honestly, every production, it seems to kind of like spark discussion among, you know, theater audiences and places that it's played. So yeah, even if I'd never had an opportunity to adapt it into a film, I would have totally been satisfied with what I've been able to accomplish with just the stage version of it. But again, there was a request and a desire to see it as a film, and I felt like I was capable enough to write that adaptation myself. So, you know, I'm glad that I did it.
Kemp Powers, thank you so much for being on the show today.
Good to chat with you again.
Sounds so good, yeah. Ah, yeah, that's the sound of the men working on the chain. The game, that's the sound of the men working on the chain. Game, can't you hear them?
Gianni Washington was on the show a couple of months back with part one of a brand new story she'd been working on, called Homunculus. It's about a doll maker named Miles, who can make the greatest wish of the grieving come true. You may access that broadcast at any time by visiting the Great American Folk Show page on prairiepublic.org. Just look for episode 8. Let's listen in now to part two of that story.
In bed at night, his body yearns for hers. He reaches forward, hoping to catch hold of her warmth, but Esther has her own room downstairs. She does not require sleep, but enjoys her privacy nonetheless. Sometimes, when Miles passes her closed door, he hears her speaking softly to Madeline, the doll he'd made for her out of burlap stuffed with handkerchiefs after months of Esther crying for a companion of her own. With every stitch, jealousy had eroded him further. Was he not enough? That's not what she meant, and he knew it, she'd said. So he'd finished cobbling Madeline together out of the least appealing materials he'd had to hand in hopes that Esther would feel the lack and crave his touch instead. But Esther was quite satisfied with Madeline as she was. He would have made Esther a doll out of his own skin, had she asked. He would have done anything. Absolutely anything. Thank you. Oh, thank you! Hello, Daniel, the doll says to the overjoyed man. Her hair is more white blonde than yellow, and she has a face smooth as milk. She looks like the woman in the photograph as a child on the cusp of womanhood, and always would. The adult-sized models never functioned properly for long, so Miles stopped making them in favor of smaller models with longer lifespans. The people who came to him did not mind, for they were so hungry for a glimpse of their lost loved ones that any version of them would do. His latest creation looks happily now upon her new guardian. "I can't begin to thank you," Daniel says to Miles. Would it help him in the end? Over the years, Miles had cultivated three answers. The one he'd give a customer, the one he'd give a colleague if he had one, and the one he knew in his heart to be true. Well, one can hurl shoulds into the wind forever.
"I'm happy you're satisfied," Miles replies.
He allows a small smile to ripple his otherwise placid face. Let him figure out the answer on his own. It might be different. Miles will never know either way. Daniel hands Miles a pouch heavy with coins and leaves the cafe, arm in arm with his new old friend. She laughs as the bell above the closing door tinkles.
"Esther," Miles says later that night, "do you wish for another life?"
"No," she says to his great relief. "I can't imagine a life other than the one I have."
"You can have any life you choose," he says.
His words are sharp, pained. She stares at him with the third pair of eyes to ever look at him that way. An eternity elapses. "I choose this life," she says finally. "I know you feel an emptiness, and I am happy to fill it." Miles' mouth contracts to its smallest point.
"I don't need you to fill my empty spaces. I want you to be happy," he says.
He wills his words to be true. "It's all right," Esther says. Her voice is flat, but not unkind. "I don't mind that you need me."
He does need her, and always will. The missing will never reach its end. He knows, because he will never let it.
"I'll give you anything you ask for," he whispers, tears in his eyes. She brings her elfin hand softly to his face and smiles. "I ask only for this life, with you."
Musician and songwriter Isabella Rose. Currently, she's in the studio working on a new album after a long hiatus. She has a voice that's spiritual. It rides on waves. And I'm certain these waves will brush on the shores of your heart in the same way they brushed on the shores of mine. Which is to say, she is magnificent.
I wanted to thank you for having me tonight on this show, Great American Folk Show. It's a real honor to be here. And thank you, North Dakota. Thank you, Tom, for having me. It's been 20 years since I've actually written and sung a song on any kind of radio show. Years ago, I did the whole thing, Europe, and put out records and had a great time being free. But at one point, I was taken on a wild, dangerous road trip down to Arizona and held against my will in the desert. In a tent, in the desert, a man had a tank of about 25, 30 guns. And he used to be part of the militia, and he thought it was fun to have me there with him. Right after I got back from tour, this happened. And I escaped somehow one day, and then 20 years went by, and I did all sorts of other things. Getting through without singing, I don't know how I did, but then suddenly this summer, somehow I began to sing again, and Tom heard this song on Facebook, of all things, and so now I'm singing here on your radio tonight. And I know what the caged bird feels, alas, when the sun is bright on the upland slopes, when the wind stirs soft through the springing glass, and the river flows like a stream of glass, when the first bird sings and the first bud opes, and the faint perfume from its chalice steals. I know what the caged bird feels. I know why the caged bird beats his wing till its blood is red on the cruel bars, for he must fly back to his perch and cling when he fain would be on the bough a swing. and a pain still throbs in the old, old scars, and they pulse again with a keener sting. I know why he beats his wing. I know why the caged bird sings, ah me, when his wing is bruised and his bosom sore, when he beats his bars and he would be free. It is not a carol of joy or glee, but a prayer that he sends from his heart's deep core, but a plea that upward to heaven he flings. I know why the caged bird sings. A wonderful poem by Paul Laurence Dunbar.
I want to go home, back through the hole. Rabbits get old, Cheshire's gone rogue. Now the tea's getting cold, Hatter's a ghost. I guess I should know whose hand to hold. So I run and I scream, this maid's lord of tea. I don't know where this leads. Oh, for a breeze. Is this just a dream?
Beautiful.
It's all so far away, the place you want to be someday. You ride a bike, you say, someday I'll fly an aeroplane. You jump, you turn around, once more you hit the ground. The autumn leaves fall down, November comes, and then you found you're in the same old place without your friend. What a waste. And the
we'd like to take a moment now and thank our sponsor, Hugo's Family Marketplace. Groceries, bakery, deli, floral, you name it, Hugo's, local and family-owned, serving 10 locations in North Dakota and Minnesota since 1939.
I know Otz Lee Kilcher from San Diego, California, probably through singer-songwriters Steve Poltz, Gregory Page, or Frank Drennan. They were good friends. but you know, I don't recall exactly. The where or when will always take the back burner when a smile is involved, and that's what I remember about Ott's, his handsome smile. He is rooted in music. It runs in his family. His mother, father, and siblings, all of them sing, and I might add they're poets and storytellers, too. These days, he has a popular reality television program on the Discovery Channel called Alaska, The Last Frontier, and he joins us now from all the way up there.
I've been fishing in the mountains and streams of Alaska since I was about 6 years old. I didn't start playing the harmonica till I was about, oh, maybe 15 years old. But I've been dealing with looking over my shoulder for black and brown bears my whole damn life. And let me tell you, best thing I ever did was start learning how to play that harmonica. Now see, when I was a kid fishing, I'd go out by myself and ignorance is bliss there for a while, you know. I mean, 9-10-year-old boy grabs a fishing pole and heads to a creek. He's aware that there's dangers, but he's more focused on that fish on the end of the line, that prospect maybe bringing home some dinner or having the fight of his life with a salmon the size of his own leg. Didn't really think much about the fact of bears, but as you get older, you know, 13, 12, 14, you start listening to the forest a little bit more and you start being more aware. You start seeing those dead fish with their heads messing on the riverbank and those big, huge brown bear tracks pressed into the mud with their claws 3 inches away from where their toes were, just like big razor blades hanging off the end of their little feet. And you start looking over your shoulder a lot more, you know? And I wasn't carrying a gun back then, you know? I was a kid going out, 14 years old. Well, I was just a boy against the wilds trying to become a man, but I was always scared, just scared. And the more scared you get when you go fishing by yourself in Alaska, the quieter you seem to get. Even though you know you ought to make more noise, you can't. You're just paralyzed and you're quiet and you hear sticks and twigs break and oh my goodness, you just don't know what it is. And I had a few encounters, mind you. You know, there were some nights I woke up in a tent where the old bear was pressing his paws against and I could see those claws dimpled into the fabric, and it's all I could do to let out a scream like a prepubescent little child with nothing but pure fear in his heart. That bear went running off that time, luckily. Finally, I thought, you know, I gotta start doing something. So I started playing harmonica. It was small enough to carry in my pocket. All I had was my fishing pole and a harmonica, and that felt pretty all right. And I'd go through the woods, and I'd start blowing through this harmonica, making all kinds of horrible noises. And I was convinced that there wasn't a critter out there, predator or prey alike, that would want to get anywhere near such a sound. So I was pretty proud of myself. Funniest thing is, through the years, I started getting pretty dang good at that harmonica. And that harmonica became a companion to me. It became my fishing buddy. Heck, it was there at my wedding. Old harmonica was there at my trials and tribulations down the crossroads about everywhere I've been in life. I've met some of the best friends in my life from playing the harmonica, and I've played the harmonica at the loss of some of the best friends in my life. And that's just kind of how things go up here in the Arctic. You find something that works and you stick with it and you turn it into your friend.
Richard Buckner is a singer, songwriter, and guitar player. He's released many albums of original music since the 1990s. But I've always considered him more of a writer as opposed to a musician or a songwriter, though he is so very talented in those departments. Last year, Black Sparrow Press published Richard Buckner's new book, Cuttings from the Tangle, comprised of 50 poetic prose entries, 51 if you include the book's final entry, author bio. It's observational, confessional, and I love this description from Black Sparrow Press. Studies wrung from thin motel walls and passing hallway echoes, from exchanges overheard between happy hour and closing time, from casually caustic conversations in junker parking lots and hash house booths, and from lost opportunities in vague chance meetings, but also from distant narrators caught staring off to recall what refuses to be forgotten. Here's Richard Buckner with Work, One More Last One, an author bio from Cuttings from the Tangle.
Author bio. Richard Buckner. Born 1964. Northern California, Idaho, Georgia, Washington, Alberta, Texas, New York. Deceased, to some, said murderer. Crawling along in nonstop flight. Only recently haunching to edit notes scribbled from subterranean overlooks in retro-present closing night debut. Circumnavigating theories of trajectory and other self-assassinating goals, career graft and scripted speculation. Rejoiced mounting benign philippics, dodging ink-horned entanglements. One more last one. Highway construction signs redirect past off-duty after-hours machinery toward a frontage road motel attached to a diner lounge with stools at the bar, seating crisscrossing dialogue under televised sports and bygone hits. An older woman, part of her blouse trapped between her bra and her belly, slouches forward, ordering one last one. Two weathered brothers laugh and look each other in the eyes as they talk in grainy cigarette timbres, trading stories of worksite coffee, trailer office liquor, and what their hourlies have done or drunk on or off the job. The bartender refills a bourbon for the brother with a belted knife sheath and long single braid, then caffeine for the other with a close cut and belt clip keys. A younger woman, a niece and a daughter ending her shift there, sits between the two, folding forward to talk to a waitress in hushed exchanges while the brother's conversations veer around her, then leans back to join in with them as the server leaves to take the dinner order for a man huddled alone at the end of the bar who wants just meat, no veggies. The sheath, the brother looks over at the man, watching the interaction, then glances at his other. The happy hour closing bell rings and the brothers rise, each pulling out their different brands of smokes, pinching into their packs, and stepping out in the night to the small parking lot with two logoed company trucks amongst the dusty sedans and compacts with bungeed trunks ajar, garbage-bagged side windows, or duct tape bumpers of the itinerant workers staying over. A few of the motel rooms have half-open doors with no movement inside besides broadcast dancing light show flashes. A small grill slopes cold on a bent leg in the middle of the dim walkway. The brothers light up and draw, touching shoulder to shoulder but facing opposite directions as if on watch for something approaching from anywhere, talking in low, serious tones about the niece, daughter, her beauty and ability to recover. One brother looking away while speaking as the other, head turned chin to shoulder, looks at the narrator while listening, both switching poses as speakers change. Only the keyclip brother returns, scooting a stool and looking straight ahead, silent as the coffee is refilled and the empty tumbler taken away. The no veggie man glances at the young woman while mumbling his tip addition. Lays some bills on the bar and walks out, crossing the lot toward the rooms, turning to look as a truck door slams and a lip butt dives to the ground in his direction. The trapped blouse woman loosely swivels her head, past then back at the bartender, raising index and middle fingers together with, "Okay, one more last one." Work. To wait, sometimes in a room but often in a car after driving to wait for something else, you park and move to the passenger seat and watch. This is work, sitting with the windows down an inch, triggered by whatever is going on, recalling the details. Times when there was no car to wait in, or when you had a car but had no business being in it, heading somewhere for reasons that no longer matter, or maybe didn't even then, ending up somewhere without consequence for the act of getting there. Places you shouldn't have gone, but, bored or obsessed, you just had to get out and stir something up. Times when you didn't have to wait, but did, or when you should have waited but just couldn't hold it in any longer, when the world was endless with places to wait. At a used car dealership recently, the salesman wouldn't stop going off, "Listen, you seem like a reasonable guy." Unaware of your work reappraising past decisions in renewable review, demanded by the weight of explanations that can't determine what drove you elsewhere then, now with nowhere left to wait.
And I'll pull along you for miles.
The Great American Folk Show would like to thank Richard Buckner, Otsley Kilcher, Gianni Washington, Kemp Powers, and Isabella Rose. Opening theme by Sean Watkins in Los Angeles, California. End theme by Berkham Boys in Council Bluffs, Iowa. Our sponsor, Hugo's Family Marketplace. The Great American Folk Show was written and recorded by Tom Brousseau. Produced and edited by Eric Detheridge and Bill Thomas. I'm Joe Wiegand. May you always find the sun until we meet again.
For more information about this program, please visit prairiepublic.org. On the next episode of The Great American Folk Show, Quinn DeVoe will be playing some music, so will Clinton Davis, and a mother and daughter combo, Nina Ricci and Teresa Ricci. We'll hear from writer Michael Patrick F. Smith. He has a new book out called The Good Hand, a memoir of work, brotherhood, and transformation in an American boomtown. Plus, Joe Wiegand with more notes from the Badlands. And more. We'll see you then.